Good afternoon. My name is Howard Goldberg, and I'd like to welcome you all to this USCJ-sponsored teleconference, Synagogue Do's, Do's and Don'ts. I'm going to introduce our presenter momentarily, Lisa Harris-Glass. Before I do that, let me explain the procedures of how the call will be run. Again, if you have not already pressed *6 on your phone to mute your phone at your end, please do so. That's very important as we are recording the call, both for your reference, so you can listen to the call at a later time, perhaps share it with other lay and professional leaders at your congregation, but also we do plan on sharing this teleconference with a wider audience later this week or early next week. So again, if you have not already done so, please press *6 to mute yourselves. After the presentation, there will be ample time for a question and answer period. And there are two ways that you can submit a question. One is if you are by a computer and you have instant messaging, you can send an instant message to me. My screen name is Howard A. Goldberg. All one word, no spaces, no underscores, no dashes. HOWARDAGOLDBERG, Howard A. Goldberg. I am monitoring a number of different instant messaging services, including AOL, MSN, Yahoo, and Google Talk. So if you are on any of those services, you can send me an instant message at Howard A. Goldberg, and I will get your question to the presenter. The other thing that you can do is when you want to ask a question, you can then press *6 again to unmute yourself, ask your question, and after you've asked your question, hit *6 again to remute yourselves. So again, you can send me either an instant message or during the Q&A, you can send me an instant message at any time, or you can unmute yourself during the question and answer period briefly to ask your question. One last time before I introduce Lisa Harris-Glass, if you haven't already done so, please do press *6 in order to mute yourself. Now, there are still one or two folks who have not pressed *6, so if you haven't, I'll give you about 30 more seconds. For those that are just coming on, please do press *6 to mute yourself. Okay, we're going to begin. I would again just ask one more time that if you have not already pressed *6, because I do hear a little bit of background noise, that you do that at this time. I'd like to introduce to you Lisa Harris-Glass, who is the Executive Director of the New Jersey Region of the United Synagogue of Conservative Judaism. Lisa joined the USCJ in September 2006 after 14 years spent working in conservative synagogues in New Jersey. She is a much-in-demand workshop facilitator and has traveled internationally to work with synagogue boards. Areas of her expertise include board development, fundraising, committee development, membership, including recruitment, integration, and retention, synagogue operations, SMART goal setting, and volunteer development. Lisa has served on the International Board of Governors and the local board of the North American Association of Synagogue Executives, NAASE, and is a past president of Metro NAASE. She co-chaired the International NAASE Convention in Las Vegas in 2006 and in New York City in 2000. She also created and chaired NAASE's Mentoring Initiative, a program that pairs new executive directors with more seasoned colleagues who serve as resources and mentors. In 2006, Lisa was awarded the Nathan H. Winter Professional Excellence Award by the United Synagogue of Conservative Judaism, New Jersey Region. She was the first executive director to be recognized with this award. In 2004, Ms. Glass received NAASE's Professional Accreditation Fellow in Synagogue Administration, FSA. She was the youngest woman to ever earn the FSA and was at that time the only synagogue professional in New Jersey to hold this accreditation. That same year, she was named one of the 40 under 40 by the Metro West New Jersey Jewish News, an honor that recognizes outstanding young leaders in the Metro West Jewish community. Again, I please ask you to press star 6 if you have not done so already, and I now present to you Lisa Harris-Glass.
Good afternoon to you all. Thank you for joining us. There are just about 150 participants on today's phone call, and we had over 100 last evening. And I think this level of participation speaks to the fact that although each of our congregations is unique, we all face many of the same challenges when it comes to synagogue operations. Can you please hit star 6 on your phone to mute yourselves? Thank you. Today's seminar on do's, do's and don'ts was originally named Managing Membership Income and Financial Hardship. Not quite as catchy as the title we went with, but I do feel it conveys the essence of what we're going to discuss today. Also, I wanted to take a moment to convey the genesis of today's topic. As our moderator, Howard Goldberg, shared with you, I am the Regional Director of United Synagogues New Jersey Region. As such, I often receive queries from my synagogues about matters of synagogue policy and operations. Interestingly, in early December, I received the exact same query from two congregations within 5 days of each other. That being, how do synagogues handle collections? I sat down to focus my thoughts about what the best practices were in this area. As I ordered my ideas, I set about researching examples of what I considered to be the best methods to share with my congregations. What resulted was a paper entitled Do's, Do's, and Don'ts, which United Synagogue published. It was at that juncture that Barry Mail, United Synagogue's Chief Service Delivery Officer, had the idea to offer the ideas and concepts present in that paper via the teleconference format, thinking that if we received two queries in 5 days, then this must be a hot topic. Clearly, he was correct, which brings us to today. As we move into our topic, I remind you once again that after my presentation, I will invite you to ask questions and that you can IM your questions to our moderator, Howard Goldberg, as previously suggested. The moderator will have the first opportunity to pose questions at the end of the call. As we begin our discussion on collection issues, we should pause first to talk about how each synagogue perceives dues versus how many members perceive dues. Are dues a fee for service, be they life cycle, calendar cycle, Shabbat service? Are they an association fee, like belonging to the country club? Are they purely a charitable donation? I bring this up because as we explore what to do when people don't pay dues, it's important to think about what the member is thinking that they're not paying. In other words, are they unable to meet a charitable donation versus are they not meeting a moral obligation versus not meeting a business obligation? Often the leadership, which consists of the people who really get it, cannot understand the mindset of the non-payers. After all, we understand that the concept of dues comes right from the Torah. Many of our members do not. I invite you to spend some time within your own institutions discussing this issue and perhaps exploring how to best educate people about this most biblical of obligations, dues. So, when it comes to managing membership income, one of the first questions I ask the synagogue is, are people obligated to pay dues? Now, I'm not looking to have an existential conversation. What I want to know is how to make the obligation to pay dues a legally binding commitment. My recommended first step is to have all members sign a membership renewal and High Holy Day ticket order form every year. The form needs to be mandatory and should state your quote-unquote official dues payment policy. No matter what form you use, it needs to include language that obligates the member to their financial obligations for the year. For example, I understand that by requesting High Holy Day tickets, I'm obligated to pay the full amount of my annual dues, capital fund, security fees to Temple Beth, insert your name here. Tickets are non-transferable and non-refundable. I have a sample of one that we're going to email you at the end of the call, and it's courtesy of B'nai Torah Congregation in Boca Raton, Florida. Great form. You're going to love it. Do note that we are going to talk about how to handle it when people don't meet their obligations. But before we go there, I'd like to discuss how we handle members who ask for financial accommodation. I strongly recommend the use of a financial disclosure statement for adjusted dues. I have a great form that you'll be sent after the call. But the major reasons why I believe this form works are that it takes the user through a journey of looking at their spending in a realistic way, a little introspection, if you will. For instance, if they belong to the country club, drive two new cars, and have a $200 a month cable bill, they may think twice about asking for extraordinarily low dues. The form goes on to ask about dependents and tuition, occupation information, including income, other income, restaurant expenses, medical expenses, and leaves a place for the member to make a statement as to why they need an adjustment and how much they can afford. When you see it, you'll notice that instead of asking for a person's name, the form has room for numbering. This allows for the user to feel comfortable that their personal business will remain confidential. When the form is requested, the form gatekeeper should log in the request into a binder, into an Excel spreadsheet, whatever it is you're using, and assign the family a number. The baby that makes decisions should only be privy to the family number and not the identity. This may also help in recruiting people to the committee, as there'll be no reason for committee members to worry about having an uncomfortable situation with a friend or neighbor. You'll notice that the form does not request tax forms. And frankly, I have no official position on the tax form issue. Some communities, people would not flinch to ask for these forms, nor would the person asking for accommodation flinch to provide them. However, in many communities, just the opposite is true. With the form I recommend, I believe that it would be a rare person who could admit to wild spending habits and then ask for accommodation. And if they did, well, then I guess we all have to be able to look at ourselves in the mirror at the end of the day. So what then? Well, once a dues relief agreement has been agreed to, the party requesting the dues relief needs to sign a membership renewal and payment schedule form. You're getting a sample of that after the call, too. So, what happens when a member is not meeting their obligations? This applies to members on payment plans, reduced dues, and full dues. What do we do when they don't pay? You need to have a plan. First, what's our timeline? For some of you who require a dues down payment for High Holy Day tickets before they go out, then your timeline will be much accelerated to the one that I'm about to describe. I'm sure you can adjust it, and if you need assistance, please feel free to contact me after the call, and I can give you some advice. Now, let me note before we go further that you must keep records of contacts. If you are calling, log it into the member file or your Excel spreadsheet. If you're sending letters, keep copies in the member file. You will need them later. Now, for the timeline. I recommend a series of letters be developed that move from gentle to firm, that are sent out at regular intervals, beginning 7 or 8 months into your fiscal year. These should always restate the agreement or constitutional requirement for payment, reflect any conversations you've had with the member, and outline next steps, including deadlines. Now I'm going to repeat that because it's really important. They should restate the agreement or constitutional requirement for payment, reflect any conversations you have had with the member, and outline next steps, including deadlines. Also, don't be afraid to have the letters come from different players. Utilize your treasurer, your financial secretary, your executive director, etc. We're sending you some sample letters in the email you're getting after the call. In addition, the letters should remind the person that there are procedures for dealing with a hardship, and they should please make contact, and that special circumstances or financial hardship will be handled in a discreet and compassionate manner. The second letter should include all the components of the first, but may also wish to say a few words about how the congregation uses dues to maintain all of its programming and services that it provides to members. The last letter should state what your next steps will be, which leads me to my next point, that being, key leadership must discuss what, if any, are your procedures for dealing with members who refuse to meet their obligations. Will you dismember them? Ooh, groan, I'm sorry, a bad joke, but you get my point. Are we going to discontinue their membership? Will you move an account into collections? Do keep in mind that anything you do can end up in the media. We'll be emailing you a newspaper story from January of 2001 regarding a congregation that sued a former member for back dues, so you can see that it really can end up in the newspaper. Next, I encourage you to have your plan mapped out before the step becomes necessary. It is a plan best made when emotions are not running high. For instance, determine what penalty, if any, a family with an upcoming bar or bat mitzvah will incur for lack of payment. Will the bar or bat mitzvah be moved off of Shabbat? Out of the sanctuary? No change at all? It's important to consider these matters. What about preschool? Do payment and lack of payment plans follow the same rules as for dues and religious school tuition? We have to talk about it. With a plan in place and some effort made at the beginning of each fiscal year, I believe you'll find yourselves in a much stronger position for collecting receivables. I also believe that having a written, thorough plan will make it easier to enforce agreements, as there'll be no surprises for members and leadership. Now, I'd actually like to stop at this point and ask our moderator if he has any questions that have popped up. We're going to be moving into our Q&A. Again, you can IM questions to the moderator, Howard Goldberg. And once he's done, then you can hit star six and start to ask questions.
So at this time, I don't have any questions via instant message, but I'll just state what my screen name is again, in case people want to ask me questions via instant message. My screen name is Howard A. Goldberg, HOWARDAGOLDBERG, no spaces, no underscores. Howard A. Goldberg. I am on AOL, MSN, Yahoo, and Google Talk, so you can reach me at any of those instant message services. And in addition, since we don't have any questions via IM right now, those who would like to ask a question, you can hit star 6 to unmute yourself, ask your question, but then do please star 6 again to remute yourself. So if anybody has a question, please do feel free to ask it now. I'm sorry.
In New York, I have a question.
Go ahead.
Okay.
Yep.
We have a dues renewal form that we send out to the congregation every year. It goes with a letter from the treasurer telling everyone that it's very important that they tell us what their commitment will be for the new year. This year, we did not invoice anyone until we got the form back. At this point, in the middle, almost the end of January, we've only received about 100 forms back. And this is a chronic problem. A couple of years ago, we were dying. We had no money coming in. It was already March or April, and the decision was made, well, we're just going to invoice everyone at last year's dues level, fair share dues. And that's what we did, but then the amount of money that came in every year became static. So what's the solution? Do you have any suggestions for how to get people to fill in that form and send it back?
Well, may I ask you a question? How do they get their high holiday tickets?
Well, they have to be paid up and in good standing by then, but that's not until next September.
When does your fiscal year start?
January 1st.
Aha, okay.
If they don't send in the form, we can't invoice them. If we don't invoice them, they seem to feel that they have no obligation to pay.
Hmm.
And at the end of the year, before High Holy Days, when we really start sending out letters and making phone calls, that's when we get the news, oh, we're not renewing this year.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really two separate issues. But my question really has to do with the yearly dues form that you suggested,
mm-hmm.
which we send, but people do not send it back.
Right, and admittedly, it is a form that works best with a synagogue that's on a July 1 fiscal because people need to fill it out to get their high holiday tickets, and they don't get tickets until you have the form.
That's a good point.
And I think that, you know, I may need to talk to you at greater length, you know, offline of the call because this is sort of a unique situation. But you may want to talk about the fact that, you know, if you're going to have fair share dues, invoicing them every January 1st at whatever they paid last year plus 5% until you hear differently might help with your cash flow, or even consider if maybe that is what's serving you best at this point and it might not be time for some kind of change.
Mm-hmm.
But do feel free to sort of give me an email offline and maybe we could spend some more time talking, because I think that this is sort of like a way bigger question.
Okay,
then
thank you.
Tackle here. Okay.
Lisa?
Yeah.
My name's Max Popper. I'm with Temple Beth Shalom, Long Beach, California.
Hi, Max.
Hi. We do use the CPR. Our fiscal year starts on July 1st. The request that I would have is I would certainly like to see a copy of your original article on the do's and don'ts so that we could go along with your talk today. I think it would be a lot easier for people to understand along with the forms.
Couldn't
is that
agree
possible?
More. You're all getting it within hours after our phone call is over today. It'll be emailed out to all the people who signed up because we have your email addresses. So once the call is over, the paper is going to be emailed out.
Wonderful. Thank you.
This is Bob Catterick.
I'm sorry, Bob. Bob, don't stay on the line. I'm just going to interject because we've gotten a few questions via instant message, and I want to make sure that we intersperse those in with the people online. So, Bob, you're next up after I'm done.
And I won't forget, Bob. That Jules right here. So
okay.
I know. Okay, go ahead.
So first, a comment that I received, Lisa, and then I'll ask you a question. The comment is that one of the participants has said that they have a commitment form that they do send out to all congregants, and they don't release the high holiday tickets until the form is signed and returned, and they don't invoice dues until the commitment card is returned. So that's a comment that we have. The first question that we have is, and this is a good one, what is the process when a congregant unit is politically connected within the synagogue and is not paying their fees in a timely fashion?
So, okay, that's a great question. I would say to you, this is why you need to have a written policy that sort of goes out by rote, if you will. So if you have a policy that says anyone who hasn't paid $1 by, you know, 8 months into the fiscal year gets the following letter, and it's just triggered automatically, then those people will get it. Because I think you can't take it on a case-by-case basis. It's why I want you all to create a process in advance so you can have something that you can just trigger. And it's really also important for whatever staff person is the trigger point for that. You know, if you have a bookkeeper or an executive director or office manager who's going to be the trigger point to be able to say, well, you know, I sent the letter because that's what our policy is. And then if that person balks, you know, to the president, then the president has to be prepared to say, you know, I need you to be my emissary in this area. And let me tell you why we have it and why it's really important to us that you do this. And you have a financial problem you didn't even necessarily know you were having. But if it's just out of stubbornness, I think you have to send some leadership who are the right leadership, you know, friends of the guy, of the member unit, to discuss it with them, make them your emissary, and get them on board with why it's so important to have things in order.
Okay.
Howie?
Yep. No, I have more questions, but Bob, I said it was your turn, and indeed it is.
Okay.
Bob, are you there?
Yes, this is Bob. First of all, we use a statement on our membership application, which basically obligates the congregant until such time that they notify the office in writing that they have discontinued their membership. This has worked very well for us, especially when we go to collect people who stop paying and what I refer to as silent resignation,
mm-hmm.
if they have used services. However, how do you feel about getting to the point where you actually institute a legal action against someone to collect the monies owed to the synagogue?
Okay. You know, I worked at three synagogues in your neighborhood, Bob, as you know, and in two of them, we didn't hesitate to send people to collections when we really felt that we had exhausted every other avenue, and that included a series of letters that we had ready that would go out, phone calls when they weren't responding. You know, they would end up getting a final letter that said, you know, we called you on X, Y, and Z date. We sent you a letter on this date, and then on this date, and then on this date, and you know, assuming that you haven't moved, which we assume that you haven't because nothing's come back, you need to know that if we don't hear from you by X date, we're sending your account to collections. And it would work. You know, they would either call you and try to settle something up, make a deal, or we'd send them to collections, at which point, you know, you get a percentage because the collection agency also gets. But I would say, you know, the copy of the newspaper article about the synagogue that sued the member for back dues is from Metro West. It's right for in your backyard. I mean, it was about 7 or 8 years ago at this point, 8 years ago. You just have to be prepared to deal with the consequences. You have to know that you have your ducks in order, that you can show to anybody who asks, we did everything in our power, and this person refused to speak to us. So, but, you know, I'm not against it.
Oh, this is Steve.
Hi, Steve.
Hey, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Thank you. What do you do when you have a philosophical issue concerning not allowing a child to become a bar mitzvah because the rabbi, for example, feels that we're a synagogue and not a business, and we have to be sensitive to those issues?
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's a really good question. And one of the things I said, and I know I said a lot of things, so I'll say it. First of all, I do think this is absolutely a conversation every one of you has to have. What are we going to do if the parents aren't meeting their obligations and, you know, we've made deals and they're not meeting their requirements and the child's having a bar mitzvah? I mean, if indeed the family has nothing that they can give, I assume that the congregation would move forward without a problem. We're really talking about the family that seems to have money for the $30,000 party but doesn't want to pay their dues. Is that correct? Okay, maybe you muted yourself.
Yes.
Okay, all right. There are other options. I mean, I have been in congregations where we've discussed, do we move the bar mitzvah off of Shabbat, you know, saying, well, bar mitzvah your child, but on Monday or Thursday. Or maybe we'll bar mitzvah your child on Shabbat, but we're not going to do it in the sanctuary. You know, those are conversations you have to have. And I will tell you, you know, I've been in rooms where they've taken place, and you know, I think that you have to just meet with those parents and say, don't play us. You know, there will be a repercussion. We're not going to let you have the big grand bar mitzvah on the bima if you're paying every bill but ours. And you have an obligation to help support the community and keep the rabbi in the community. And you're going to meet it. And, you know, we sat with you and you made an agreement and you're not meeting your agreement. And you have to really be vigilant in following up with these families. But do have the conversations and decide what those repercussions are going to be, because you have to be armed with something, and you want to do it when emotions are not high, when it's not about, you know, the Schwartz family, you know, when it's just about family X.
Can I ask you one other question, or are there other people waiting?
Oh, go ahead. I'll let you sneak one in.
Let's just go back to the beginning when we send a form out that states our policies, and you get the high holiday tickets, because we're on a July 1 fiscal year, and you get the high holiday tickets if you send the form back.
Uh-huh.
We are concerned that we wouldn't get a lot of the forms back, and yet there would be the clear expectation that we've always gotten our tickets and we want our tickets, or people would come without tickets.
Okay. It's kind of a two-part question, and one of the things, first of all, I think if you're going to start using a form and you haven't used a form before, is you need to educate your community that the form is coming, and that starts now. January would be when I would start that process of having these discussions to get my community ready for Yom Tov. And what I would do is we're getting a lot of conversations, so somebody needs star six, please. Star six to mute, please.
Okay, coming in?
Yes.
Star 6 to mute. Thank you. You need to start having this conversation with your senior leadership about, your senior staff, your rabbi, your executive director, or your office manager saying, we feel we need to do this. And one of the things you can say is, and now's a great time to institute this, because you can say, you know, due to the current economy, we need to have a sense of the size of our membership and what kind of dues we can expect, because we need to make sure we're not spending more than we're taking in. We have to remain true to our budget. And the only way we can really account for who's remaining in membership is to have people renew their membership on an annual basis. So this is actually, because of what's happening in our economy at this time, a great time to start this process. And as far as the people who refuse to do it, you have to send emissaries. I mean, it takes some legwork in the beginning. You have to send people to talk to them, and, you know, maybe someone from, like, their age group, their chevra, to say, you know, hey, the synagogue needs to do this, and this is why, and it's so we know what the budget is, and everyone's doing it, and you're not going to get your tickets. And, I mean, the ticket thing is interesting. I've never worked at a synagogue that didn't have a security guard at the door, so the tickets mattered. You had to have them to get in.
Yeah, but the problem there is we have security at the door, mm-hmm. but I think just the nature of a synagogue and the security people is that someone who came to the door and said, look, I don't have my tickets, I left them at home, they might take a name down if they were not, because they wouldn't be Jewish, so they'd be able to write and they take a name down, but I don't think anyone is getting turned away, at least in my experience.
It depends on the synagogue, but I would also say, however big or small that, you know, you have to do your best to attack the whole list if it means sending people out to drive to people's houses to get signed in the first year and to really make it work. What are you going to have? Nine or ten names on that list? Well, then you can follow up with them individually. But I think, you know, if you can get the majority in and get it rolling, it's really going to serve you well.
Lisa, I have a question for you.
Actually, before, I'm sorry. Let me, don't get off the line. Hold on to your question. I just want to get, we want to get some of the instant messaging that have come.
Okay.
Lisa, this question is, do you have any suggestions on how a fair share synagogue should handle these kinds of issues? Since dues are essentially up to each member, they feel they have the freedom to set dues as low as they want. And their attempts to enforce a minimum have not been very successful.
Hmm. Okay. I mean, I do think that in certain instances, if it is, and I know that if your minhag, if your custom is to be fair share, it may be hard to change that custom. If you're finding that you're really not getting enough to run your operation, then you may have to have a big congregational meeting and discuss the fact that you don't have enough money to pay the rabbi and pay the electricity, and you may need to change the way you're paying your dues. The other thing is, when you see the financial accommodation form that you're about to get at the end of the call, take a look at that form, because you may want to use that. I don't know what you're currently using for your sheet for people to pay their fair share, but it might be an interesting exercise to add into how they go about setting their dues, because if they're doing something, seeing that they're spending $200 a month on cable and $120 a month on cell phones and, you know, $100 a month at restaurants, it may be a little harder for them to say they can only spend $50 a month on dues. And so you may just need to reevaluate how people set it. And if you need to set a minimum, your congregation is just, your board's going to have to do that. But you have to educate your community as to what's happening. And, you know, I said last night, and I'll say it again, you know, I've never been shy to say to every now and then put a blurb in the bulletin that says, did you know? And say, you know, did you know that the congregation spends $75,000 a year to heat the building? And people have no clue. They have no clue what it costs. Did you know that we spend, you know, all of our insurances combined cost us $25,000 a year? We have to start to dribble that information out, because I know we all sort of send those little budgets out around budget time, but they're like summary budgets and how many people really come to the congregational meeting. I think it's good to sort of pepper that information out, let people get a sense of what it's really costing to do business. Howie, do you have another one?
Well, I think his name was Steve. If the other individual who was going to ask a question,
yeah,
let's give them a turn,
okay,
and I'll come back with more.
Sure, okay.
I'm still here. My question was, should we take into consideration what our area synagogues do? Does that play into our decision?
About whether, in what matter, what your dues are, or
how we handle collections, how far we want to take somebody for collections, certain policies, if we're stricter than all of our other synagogues in our area, that might lead people away from us. Should that be a consideration?
You know, it doesn't hurt to consider it. You could consider it and discard it. I do think it's important to educate yourself about what's doing with the competition. You know, just like you, every year you find out what all the local synagogues are charging for dues, or you join a salary survey to find out what people pay synagogue staff. This is the same thing. You may want to talk to your counterparts and find out what's going on. You may ultimately decide you can't live with that, but it's good to know.
Lisa, I actually have a somewhat related question from instant messaging. The question is, do you suggest suing members in small claims court?
Do I suggest suing them in small claims court as opposed to collections?
It wasn't clear on the instant message, but I assume that that would be one, that over other options, yes.
I don't know that I actually have a recommendation between suing them in small claims court and taking them to collections. I think that as long as you've had a discussion in your congregations and that your board, your president, everyone's going to stand behind whatever decision gets made, and that it's made consistently, you can do whatever you need to do. But again, you know, you get into small claims court and that becomes a matter of public record and it could get into the media. So definitely something to be considered. Okay. A question from the group?
Hello?
Yes.
This is Jeff Sopwith from Adat Shalom in Farmington Hills, Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And from listening to the discussion and a question that occurred earlier, it seems like the better practice is to have your fiscal year start sometime before the holidays. Ours, unfortunately, is the opposite, and we start our fiscal year on November 1. So we have a group of people that tend to pay before the end of the calendar year for tax purposes, and then everybody else pays just before the holidays. So you don't really know what you have until the holidays come along.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like the better practice is to try to get yourself on a different fiscal year. And if you've had experience with congregations that have changed their fiscal year, and then I guess the other part of my question is, if you don't change your fiscal year, how do you really? What's the best way to implement this when you have a fiscal year that comes after the holidays? Thank you.
That's a great question, and I don't know that I would say to you, you know, it is best practice to have a July 1 fiscal. I mean, it's what I know, and it's what I think the majority of synagogues have, and I do, and it works for the natural reason because the high holidays are right there. I don't have personal experience with a congregation changing their fiscal year, but I'm sure that we could put a query out and find one that did, which would be a way to sort of get you in touch with someone who's been through the process, because synagogues do this from time to time. I'm sorry, you said something else about how do we get them obligated for membership at that point in the year. It does make it harder. I mean, it also, I would imagine, also creates some challenges when it comes to getting your receivables in, that from the time you bill to the time you actually start to get the money in before the high holidays, you know, that's a lot of months without strong receivables, let's say, from December 31st where you got in all the end of the year stuff till maybe August. So you might want to talk about the way to change it. I mean, you can still do your membership renewal, but I agree with you. It's going to be harder for you to get that information in. And, you know, if there's anyone on the call who has some real advice about this, you know, I'm smart enough to know when I'm not smart enough to know. And I just don't,
Lisa, corollary to that is we've talked about trying to have a quarterly billing.
Mm-hmm.
And putting some teeth into it, but I think that everybody would know that it doesn't mean anything because we have no leverage over a person until the holidays come.
Right, or unless they have.
And in our experience, we've never sued. We absolutely, yeah. If somebody has a SIM card, it's one thing, but I think in our experience, we've never sued anybody, and so I mean, we could be threatening to people, but I don't think anybody would really believe it.
Well, and that's another issue. I mean, it's something you may have to discuss, or you're going to decide that our position is we're never going to do that, and then you're just not going to have any teeth. So it sounds like, to me, like you guys need to have some kind of change to improve your cash flow. And I think you're going to have to, you know, I hope that you have the buy-in of your executive committee and your board in trying to investigate, trying to f-
find a system that has some teeth, maybe investigate taking making a move on your fiscal so that you can try to get the cash flow moving.
Lisa.
Go ahead.
Lisa, this is Scott Dancy. May I ask you a question?
Yes.
I think our biggest obstacle, I love the process, the written policy. This is all wonderful, and it's right up my avenue or my alley. My biggest obstacle, we have a large board, some 30 people, and getting them to agree to do just about anything to change. You know, we want to be we want to not put kids' mitzvahs in the way. We don't want to get any, you know, I have such hesitancy to get them to allow me to use credit cards for collections or anything. I'm just wondering if you have any silver bullets to use to get a group, the board, to change policy so that there's a little more regiment and procedure and process and not the fear that we don't want to ostracize any family.
Right. Well, I think one of the things is you have to maybe devote a board meeting and challenge them to come up with an alternative method. The board does have a fiduciary responsibility to the congregation, and so maybe what you do, and, you know, I'm sure that, you know, I or, you know, your regional director would be happy to help you come up with some scenarios, some role-playing where we can say, okay, you know, we don't want to put this in the way. This person owes us this much money. This is our economic situation. You know, we can't, you know, I'm assuming that it is impacting your bottom line. There's no teeth around, you know, and saying to the board, let's problem solve this because, you know, it's all great to say, oh, it's okay, it'll be all right, but when you run out of money, how are you going to turn the lights on?
Well, it also seems the rabbi is one of our biggest adversaries on this because it's, you know, he doesn't want to have anyone feel that there's any obligation. You know, he just wants it to be a perfect world.
Well, I understand that, and I understand, you know, that the rabbi wants to be a good guy or girl or, you know, I don't know what you have there. But I think that you definitely have to have, and I mean, like someone with a one-on-one or a two-on-one conversation with the rabbi to make him your ally in this conversation and say, you know, the bottom line is we need to pay your salary. We need to keep the lights on. We need to provide for the parsonage or whatever it is you do. And that while we agree, you know, theoretically with what you're saying, there are the cold, hard facts of keeping this institution running, and we need you to be a part of these conversations, maybe in helping us find an alternative, like what we said, you know, moving, you know, not having the bar mitzvah, but maybe moving, you know, degrading the pomp and circumstance of it if the person's not meeting their obligation. But it's definitely a process, and I think you have to, I would challenge your board and challenge your rabbi to be a part of coming up with an acceptable solution because doing nothing is not an option. And I just want to go back to the question I had just before about the November 1 fiscal year. The other thing you could think about doing, you know, I'm thinking as I'm going here, is you could also encourage maybe ongoing automatic monthly billing or using credit cards. You know, maybe start to get people used to the idea of paying monthly, like other bills, and maybe that would help increase your cash flow also. Okay, Howie, I understand you have a bunch of questions.
I do. So I'm going to try to get some of them in. Let me just, before I ask the question, we're going to be ending the call at approximately 4 p.m., and I'm thrilled to say that I'm actually dealing with about 7 or 8 different instant messaging windows right now, and there are people who are giving me both really interesting and insightful comments, and there are other questions that if we don't get to all the questions on the call today, I know that Lisa would be happy to speak with you, and when we send you the email with the recording of the call and the packet of information that Lisa has referenced, Lisa's contact information will be there, and I know that she would be happy to speak with you. So this is going back a little while, and it's a shift of topic, but the question is this: how are multi-year obligations, such as a building fund, typically handled? In other words, this individual shul allows the $3,000 building fund to be paid over 6 years. If someone resigns after a year, having paid $500, would you consider the $2,500 balance to be due to the synagogue?
I would not.
Why is that?
Because you gave them 6 years, right, to pay it out. And the fact is, when that person goes somewhere else, eventually they're going to owe a building fund somewhere else. I just, I don't. You asked me. That's my answer.
That's good. Let me sneak one more in from the instant messaging world. And it's a timely question. How do you deal with the current economic climate when someone is out of work and they say to you, I either pay you or I pay the light bill? You've answered this a little bit, but this is a direct question in terms of, you know, people who are really suffering serious and critical financial distress.
What do I say to them when they say they can't pay dues?
Well, they say, I either pay you, meaning the synagogue, or I pay my personal electric bill.
I say, pay the electric bill, and what can we do to set you up? So maybe do you need some food? This is a tough time for synagogues, but if someone loses their job and they can't afford to live, then the synagogue has to say, you know, be amongst the first to say, you know, we understand and we'll be here for you during this hard time. And, you know, when you're back on your feet, we'll too. And you may not want to erase the bill, but maybe you want to defer the bill. But I wouldn't blink to say, no, please pay for your electricity and your food first.
Okay. Is there anybody else on the call who would like to ask Lisa a question directly via the phone?
Yeah, can you hear me?
I can.
Okay, this is Marilyn Wolf, Kar Shalom in Potomac, Maryland.
Hi, Marilyn.
Hi. It's sort of a similar question to the previous, but it's slightly different. If you have someone who wants to join your synagogue, who does not yet belong, and that person is in a complete financial crisis, and they have kids, and they want to put the kids in religious school, and they want to get on bar mitzvah, but you know that they're not going to have money in the near future to pay much of anything. I just wonder what people's experience with that is. In other words, the difference between someone who's already a member and falls into hardship, or somebody who's not yet a member.
Well, I will tell you that in my years working as an executive director, there was many a family that came past my desk in just this situation. And, you know, my answer was always, we don't turn away anybody from membership because they don't have the ability to pay the membership dues. And our hope is that we would engage them and maybe that they would become active and involved. But we never felt that we could deny a child a religious education because of the parent's lack of ability to pay. So in my experience, I have not seen a congregation turn down a membership because they knew the person would never be able to pay the dues. It's just one of those, you know, maybe they lost a job when they were there, or maybe they lost a job before they asked, but if they need to be affiliated and be part of a community and educate their kids, then they do, and the synagogue steps up to the plate.
Okay.
Howie, do you have something?
Let the
caller go first.
Okay, sure.
I have a question regarding your last answer.
Yeah.
If a family, as you say, and we have many of those folks coming to our synagogue wanting to join, wanting to get the mitzvah lessons for free and the like, but then they're out of work or whatever, do you think it's proper to impose on them that they volunteer their time, doing things for the synagogue, even perhaps becoming members of the board and capacities such as communications or whatever. Mm-hmm. Do you think that that's a valid reason, a valid approach in light of the fact that they're going to give the synagogue very little money?
You know, I love that you asked me this question. It brings me back many years ago at one of the synagogues I worked at. We actually introduced this concept there. I guess it was a very Reaganomic workfare, if you will. And we sort of came up with a brochure saying, you know, we'll give you like dues credit for helping out in the office or for doing this and that. I mean, and I do actually think it's important to have representation and leadership from people other than the people with deep pockets. I think it's hard to impose it on the people who can't afford. I mean, you can encourage it, you can suggest it, you can call them and ask them to help, and maybe they'll sort of catch on. My experience when I actually did it was that it was difficult to mandate it. I'm certainly all for encouraging it and sort of actually actively asking the people, hey, if you're free today, could you come and help us collate or whatever?
Right.
You know? Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? And they may actually enjoy having a little camaraderie because it gets lonely when you're not going to the office. So.
Okay, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Lisa, this is Howie again. I'm actually having a very interesting IM chat with one of the people who are on the call who got a little bit confused. The last question that I asked about the family that had to choose between paying the electric bill versus shul dues, there was a question of whether that your answer was not consistent with the idea that you have to have a written arrangement ahead of time, and there has to be a clear policy that the synagogue has for dealing with that kind of a circumstance. And the conversation is basically going along the lines of that. And I'm asking you because I want to make sure that I'm not misrepresenting you during on this IM, but I think it's probably beneficial to everyone. Is there a difference between somebody who comes and says to you, look, I can barely buy my groceries, I can't pay the electric bill, versus the person who has, you know, the expensive car or wants to throw the $30,000 B'nai Mitzvah party, but says, yeah, but my synagogue membership isn't worth what you're charging me?
Yes, and of course, there's an enormous difference.
Right. And so, but how do you have a suggestion as to how a synagogue can formulate a policy that would deal with both of those situations? Does somebody have to fill out a form? Is it done strictly on trust? And you've covered this a little bit, but just to clarify.
Okay. Well, first of all, if the person decides that the membership isn't worth what you're charging, they don't get to make that decision. You set your dues, and that's what the dues are, and people have to pay it if they want to be a member. And certainly if they have an upcoming bar mitzvah, they don't get to choose. That's what the dues cost. And if that person wants a payment arrangement, yes, it has to be in writing. I do think it's different from the person who comes in and says, oh, my God, I've just lost my job. I didn't get severance. I don't have a month's worth of mortgage in the bank. That's a different situation. That's an emergency situation. We all get those from time to time. Another emergency might be, you know, a horrible accident or a house burning down or a big medical, unexpected medical problem. I do think, you know, there are our policies, and then there are extreme circumstances. So, I mean, and that is also different, the person who loses the job and is in dire straits, you know, without severance and without money in the bank, than the person who comes in and says, you know, hey, I make $20,000 a year. I can afford to pay $5 a month. Well, you know, yeah, put that person on a payment plan because that's just their circumstance of life. That's not an emergency circumstance. It's not the same as someone who all of a sudden finds themselves in dire straits. So I hope that clears that up and makes it seem less that I'm saying something that's contradicting, because it's not contradicting in my head. Maybe I'm not explaining it well, and I'm happy to have an offline conversation about it if the person's still feeling that I'm contradicting myself.
The person who sent you the IM is on the phone now. May I try and clarify this?
Sure.
My question really, and perhaps I didn't clarify carefully enough, my question perhaps, my concern is the future and the immediate future as we all now start encountering more and more of our congregants who have these real life issues where they're losing their jobs, they're getting reduced compensation. My concern is if there's some sort of plan or some sort of action, or how hard and fast do we hold as we see this happening to our congregations more and more. Okay. And my fear is that we will see this more and more. I know we're seeing it in our area.
Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Agora Hills, Temple Beth Haverim.
Mm-hmm.
And we are seeing it in our area, and we do have people that are losing their jobs. Our fiscal year does start in July. Clearly, I'm not going to tell somebody that they cannot continue to bring their child to school anymore. I mean, that's ludicrous. That's not the way we operate. However, my concern is that we are going to be seeing this more. And obviously, we, like every other synagogue, need a certain amount of our income also. So to just further what you said, obviously, if somebody has an emergency and they just came in and they told me that they lost their job and they don't have money for food on the table, obviously my first question is how do we help you? What can we do to help you? But again, I'm sorry, my concern is as we see this happening more and more, and I think we all will.
Right. Well, that's today's response. You mentioned two things, so let me tackle them. One of them was people are going to get maybe have reductions in their income. And that is them having to adjust to a new reality, and that may not warrant saying, okay, stop paying your dues. They may now need to get the financial assistance form and fill it out and go through and take an honest look at their income situation and see what they can now afford to pay. Ultimately, they can actually still afford to pay dues because, you know, if you go from making, you know, a quarter of $1 million a year to $100,000 a year, you can still afford your synagogue dues. You may not think that you can, but, you know, it would be up to you as a community to explain to them that they can.
Are you suggesting then that we say we're certainly sympathetic with your current situation? However, I'd like to send you a financial form to see if there's some sort of compromise or some sort of arrangement that we can work out?
Right. You could say, you know, and we want to accommodate you, we want to work with you, but I would like to have you fill out this form. That's for the dues reduction. And even for someone who comes in and says, oh, my God, I lost my job. I have no money in the bank. I don't know how we're going to eat tomorrow. You can say to them, I say, you know, don't worry about your dues bill today.
Right.
And you can, and just give them a buffer, you know. Let them sit 30, 60 days. They may get a job, and then they're going to be okay. That's why I'm saying don't erase the bill. Just say, let's just defer it for now.
Well, that's a word I use often, and we are doing that now.
Right.
But.
And then, and by the way, when I talk about financial accommodation, that gets renewed every year.
Correct.
In my book, nobody gets the same deal year after year after year unless they apply year after year after year, because you need to know about changes in their circumstance and their ability to pay.
Indeed, and I'm pleased to tell you that that's absolutely how we handle it. Our renewal, everyone must renew every year, and if they've had financial consideration in the past, they must also renew that.
That's the way to do it, so I'm glad to hear that.
May I ask a related question, please? What about those senior citizens who don't need this temple for religious school or for bar mitzvah stuff, and they're indignant about filling out a financial assistance form?
Well, if they're asking for assistance, I mean, the thing is to say to them, you know, we know you've been a member a long time, and hopefully, by the way, you're actually having programming that appeals to them and that there is still the need because they're looking for that social connection, their religious and spiritual connection with their rabbi because, you know, some people sort of feel like they need that at that time in their life.
Right.
So hopefully, and also that you're looking for ways to keep them actively engaged, even if it's as volunteers or just with programming that appeals to them, and they wouldn't want to sever that contact. But you have to say to them, you know, as you know, you appeal to them. You send an emissary, somebody maybe from their age group who's on the board who can appeal to them as someone at the same age group to say, you know, we have this policy and, you know, we want to work with you, but you have to work with us too, and we love you, and you know that, and it's completely confidential. Let me show you the form. Let me help you fill out the form. You know, what would it look like if we took them all one-on-one and didn't just make the blanket statement? But we have to, you know, those are the harder sells, and we have to, you know, redouble our efforts to sort of make them feel better about it.
Can I ask a quick question about the person who is, you know, has the two cars and has a larger income, but is still saying to us that they can't afford to pay their current dues level? How do you have a conversation with that person because you think it's a matter of priorities, and you know, and they're stating that it's just a matter that they can't pay their level?
Well, first of all, that's why you have to have the form, because you'll be able to see the reality of their situation, and if their form says they can pay it, you know, you just have, I think there are some people you just have to sit down and say, you may not think, you know, this may not be your priority, but this is what it costs us to make this available to you and your family and to educate your kids. And this is what it costs generations of people to subsidize religious education for all the kids who came before your kids. And this is what it costs to be a member. I mean, ultimately, someone say, you know, well, if you won't take me at my rate of dues, then I'm leaving. Well, maybe I have to let him go.
Lisa, I have a final question here from the IM world, and then we'll give some parting words. The question is as follows. If there is availability, I'm sorry, if we enact a policy of not sending high holiday tickets until a signed agreement is returned each year, what about members who do not send them back? Would you bill them anyway if they have not resigned?
I would.
Okay.
I'd bill them and see what happens.
Okay. I want to thank Lisa Harris Glass for developing and giving the time to present this teleconference this afternoon in partnership with the United Synagogue of Conservative Judaism. As I mentioned a number of times, in the not too distant future, hopefully by 5 p.m. or so, you will have in your email box a copy of the documents that Lisa was referring to, and you'll also have a link to listen to the recording of this call so that if you want to share it with other members of your lay and professional leadership with the hard copy documents in hand, you'll be able to do that. We have people on the call ranging from Canada to Florida out to the West Coast and everywhere in between. We're thrilled that so many of you joined us both last night and today for this teleconference, and we hope that it was valuable and useful to you. As we said, you'll have Lisa's contact information, and she would love to hear from you. We again thank you very much, and hope that you appreciate this service from the United Synagogue of Conservative Judaism, and we look forward to working with you often in the coming weeks and months ahead. Be well, everyone. Thank you.
Hooray!
Thank you, thank you.
Have fun, everyone. Yeah.
Thank you very much.